What made you have that innate desire, I'm assuming, to work really hard when you were starting your businesses? Because for a lot of people, if they have basic needs there, they're not going to work that hard.
And the answer is because I grew up getting my ass bullied so bad that I, at an early age, and this is where a lot of the therapy was necessary, I developed a little bit of a misanthropy. I was like, why the hell would I ever want to conform to a society that's populated with these assholes?
Some of the businesses that you said, you started 11 businesses. What made you, first of all, decide to start businesses in the first place?
I just wanted to do my own thing. I had these gigs where I'd play and I'd make $2,000 for an evening of piano. And I'm like, who are these people? So I'm like, man, apparently you can have freedom and money. That'd be cool.
We got a super special guest today, Jeff Lerner. Thank you for coming on. If anybody who doesn't know who Jeff is, he's an author. He's also founder of the Entre platform, which is one of the largest entrepreneurship training platforms in the world. But most importantly, before we even started this call, you said, even if you introduce me as a good person who loves his kids, that's enough, which I absolutely love. Five Times Inc., 5,000 entrepreneur. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
So grateful to be here, man. And I stand by it. My kids' opinions are the measuring stick for success in life. So
I love that. So for people who don't know who you are and they want to know more about you, I guess let's start with the zero to hero story. How did you get to this point? How did you become the five-time Inc. 5,000 entrepreneur and have the largest training platform in the world? Where did this all start from?
I appreciate that. I'll start at zero and I'll let you know if I ever get to hero. But no, I recognize objectively, you know, neutral third party self-observation, like I have had a pretty cool story, pretty interesting journey. And it started like, if I'm really being honest about where it started, I think it probably started as a kid. I grew up with pretty successful parents, like financially. And they were great parents. Like, it wasn't like they were financially successful, but behind the scenes, they were running a sex cult or something. No, they were just like, I had good parents, you know, good professional, successful parents. But it was definitely enough exposure to financial success that, like, I didn't grow up glamorizing having money because we had good money as growing up. And I was an only child. So, like, we didn't struggle as a family. But I went to this private school where a lot of the kids had a lot of money, like real money. And nobody was any happier than anybody. I mean, like, honestly, the teachers weren't any more or less, who made, you know, $45,000 a year back then or whatever, they weren't any more or less happy or well-adjusted. A lot of the students were super messed up, like, you know, typical rich person stories of like, well, the parents, you know, are only home for 3 months out of the year and they're like... some foreign service assignment. Like there, we had kids of like diplomats and army generals and corporate tycoons. And like, there's a lot of dysfunction associated with having money too, just like anything. So I feel like I was excluded from the American trap of thinking that like the way to be happy is to be rich. Cause I was actually like, I struggled a lot as a kid. I had a lot of like depression issues and social anxieties and, So I remember in my teenage years, seeing everybody around me on this sort of hamster wheel track of like, I got to get a good score on the SAT so I can get into college, or I got to pass my MCAT, or I got to, and then like pass my LSAT to get into grad school. And then like, and none of it just, and not that like law is interesting to me and medicine is interesting to me, like the subject matter is interesting to me, but these like, this obsession around like career and vocation and like finding my acceptable place in the social structure where I'm going to please my parents and I'm going to please my teachers and I'm going to please the government and I'm going to please like, it was all, everybody just seemed to be living for everybody but themselves. And I wasn't about that. And so I ended up dropping out of high school to become a jazz musician. I wanted to create, I decided that I was not going to let the pursuit of money be the defining experience or circumstance of my life. And people can say, oh, well, that's easy for you to say because you grew up with it, right? You don't know what it's like to starve and be desperate for it. But frankly, I don't think very many Americans do compared to history. Like, a poor person in America has a refrigerator and a microwave. Like, you know, it's right. None of us have it that bad. And I just, it just all seems so uninteresting to me. So anyway, I read The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, and that was the worst book I could have possibly read at 16 years old, because I was like, that's it. I'm out. And I dropped out, and I had about a 13 year career as a musician. You know, I didn't start playing piano until I dropped out at 16. And so I just went balls to the wall, practicing like 10 hours a day. I don't know. I just decided then and there, like, I'm going to make music. I'm going to make sound. That's going to be my contribution. And it took a couple of years to get good enough to be professional. But I ended up, first gigs I got was playing for food. Literally, I used to play at a place called the Reggae Hut, and they would pay me in jerk chicken dinners. And that was my first steady gig. And then I worked my way. I had a nice career in my 20s. Even as a high school dropout, I was able to get into the local University of Houston, which was a really good music program, because I got good enough to earn a music scholarship. So I think I'm the only scholarshiped musician in that program ever who lacked a high school diploma.
Wow.
Or even a GED when I enrolled. And so, yeah, I don't know, man. I've just kind of been a weirdo from the beginning. And again, when I say a weirdo, it's the simple decision to not make money the defining pursuit of my life, which is horribly un-American, I realize. And it's led me down this wonderful odyssey where, you know, people always ask, and maybe you're going to go there, they're like, well, you were $500,000 in debt, and you tried all these businesses, and you failed at all these businesses, and there you were, like, you hurt your hand, you couldn't play piano. So, you know, I'm describing where I was at when I was 29. I'd hurt my hand, I couldn't play gigs. I had failed at my 11th consecutive business that left me $500,000 in debt. I defaulted on SBA loans. I was hiding from the government, because when you default on SBA loans, the U.S. Treasury comes after you for money you obviously don't have, or you wouldn't have defaulted. And I got into online marketing, and people were like, well, how did you keep going? How did you avoid bankruptcy? How did you not just totally freak out? And yeah, I lost my apartment. I got divorced. Like, they're like, how did you keep going? And it's like, because when, like, I wasn't really at rock bottom, because I just didn't have a lot. I just had negative net worth. Like, but if money's not the defining pursuit of your life, then, like, having none of it doesn't mean your life is ruined. Which is ironic, because now I have more money than most and what most people want. But it's like, maybe there's a formula there.
Right.
You know, what Viktor Frankl said in The Man's Search for Meaning, he said, success, like happiness, is something that ensues, not something that is pursued.
I love that. So some of the businesses that you said, you started 11 businesses. What made you, first of all, decide to start businesses in the first place? Was it like you read a book or something happened? There was something that triggered you to decide, I'm going to become a businessman?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were like literary influences. I mentioned Ayn Rand. Her stories are, you know, obviously, if you read Atlas Shrugged, I mean, that's about as like avowedly pro laissez-faire capitalism as it gets. And frankly, I think has a pretty good message of what happens when you stomp capitalism out of a society and the chaos and degradation that would ensue. But it was a lot more than that. I mean, I read a lot of philosophy. I read a lot of the existentialists. I was real into Camus and like absurdism and Dostoevsky. And I just read so much. I read Kierkegaard and Solzhenitsyn, and for some reason I like Russians. But I just read a lot as a kid, and I read a lot of dystopian fiction, Brave New World, 1984 kind of stuff. Very mistrustful, very libertarian, very mistrustful of institution. One of my favorite quotes is Ayn Rand says that civilization is the process of setting man free from men. I don't trust collectives and groups that think as one. You know, Walter Lippmann said, we're all think alike, no one really thinks much. And so I just wanted to do my own thing. And so I was primed for it. And then as a musician, I started getting hired for some really good gigs within this, call it the society circuit in Houston. I'm from Houston, Texas. And a lot of these society people were like very successful entrepreneurs or corporate CEOs. I played gigs for the owners of all the professional sports teams in Houston, you know, Jim Crane, who was a trucking and logistics billionaire, Tillman Fertitta, who was a restaurant and hotels billionaire. I played for Drayton McLean, who was a billionaire in grocery distribution. I played for the Mendenhall family. They were also, I think they were nine-figure net worth grocers. Bob McNair, the owner of the Houston Texans, I played for him. He was an energy industry billionaire. I played for the CFO of Enron, if you can believe that, Andy Fowler. Like all these entrepreneurs and business people. And I'm just the piano player in the corner. Mm. You know, but those were all the best gigs. Meanwhile, I'd had some gigs where I'd literally play and I'd get paid with a plate of food. And then I had these gigs where I'd play and I'd make $2,000 for an evening of piano. And I'm like, who are these people that are paying me $2,000 to just come serenade their friends over dinner? They were all entrepreneurs. So I'm like, man, apparently you can have freedom and money. That'd be cool. Even if it's not going to be the defining pursuit of my life, I've experienced enough of life as a broke jazz musician to know that some things would be a lot easier if I could figure out how to make more of it. So I started trying to start businesses. And, you know, I went through a whole bunch of, I detail them all in my book, but I mean, it was like, I tried flipping houses, you know, doing cash advances on credit cards to buy cheap properties and flip them. And I tried, you know, credit was pretty wonky in the first decade of the 2000s. And so I was able to get access to stuff through credit cards to try all kinds of crazy things. I tried a marketing company. I tried a college couponing company. I tried an MLM. I tried a lot of stuff. But yeah, it wasn't until I started doing business online in 2008 that I kind of found my groove. Because when you're so undercapitalized, you know, physical brick and mortar business, I mean, everything is just, feels like a gut punch. It's like, oh, I got to go to Kinko's and make and print these brochures. And that's going to be $300 for these four color ink printing, you know, well, I don't have $300. So I guess I can't print my brochures. Like everything brick and mortar just felt so taxing. But once I got online, there's this like scalability and this leveraging of technology that, you know, I feel like the digital economy is, that's why I do what I do now. And I have an entrepreneurial platform where it's not even because I per se love the internet. It's just, if you're going to learn how to be an entrepreneur, it's a hell of a lot easier when everything doesn't cost a few hundred dollars because it has to be physicalized.
Mm. I love that. So take us through the practical steps, 0 to 6 figures, 6 figures to 7 figures, so on and so forth with the online business. What were the kind of the first steps that you took that started to rise? And then what were some of the challenges that you had along the path?
So when I started in 2008 online, I made my first 6 figures as an affiliate marketer, which frankly, if I was starting over today, I mean, there's a few different things I would consider doing, but I would not be opposed to the idea of starting over again as a high ticket affiliate marketer. You know, there's products out there and, you know, self-interestedly, I'll mention that Entra is one of them, but I mean, there's programs out there that you can become an affiliate of and promote and earn, you know, even with just a few sales a month, earn a living. Mm. And that's how I started. At the time I was promoting, online marketing education and financial, like a wealth seminar company. I found a couple of programs that I really believed in and that had information that I was personally interested in. So I was kind of a product of the product and I started promoting them. And, you know, back then I was running paid search ads. You could run Google ads a lot cheaper than you can now. And Google still allowed affiliate marketing to be run through AdWords. You can't do that anymore now. Back in 2012, Google decided that, for good reasons, I would add, that you can't run affiliate marketing. You can't run paid search ads direct to affiliate marketing pages that are carbon copies of pages that other affiliates have, because then you get a bad user experience on the search platform. So things have changed now, but I would still probably start with high ticket affiliate marketing, or at least strongly consider it, because the thing about affiliate marketing is like it's other companies' products and services. So you're not having to do product development. You're not having to do customer support. You're not having to get your own merchant accounts. You're not having, a lot of times you're not even having to create your own marketing assets other than maybe like a front end lander that feeds into the funnel or something. And I think that just about anybody that's willing to do the lifting over a couple years could make 6 figures as an affiliate without really any logistical limitations, let's say, or technical skill set obstacles. You don't have to know code. I mean, anybody can build funnels now with these, you know, what do they call them? Point and click funnel builders. And so, yeah, I mean, six figures is one thing. And I paid off, you know, I was $495,000 in debt when I started that. And I did it in 18 months. I paid that off. So that shows kind of how fast it can go when you get the hang of it. Again, I was using paid search ads, but if I was doing it now, I would just use influencer marketing and build a personal brand through social media, which I've done to some degree, and just sell affiliate products. But then, you know, then it's like, okay, seven figures, eight figures, nine figures, God willing, 10 figures. Like those are different games to play, right?
Right.
Because at that point, it's not the game of what business you're in. It's the game of business in whatever business you're in. And then at that point, it's about, and to be clear, what I've learned a lot, I mean, I run a company now that's done $200 million in revenue, is like all business for the most part is really about people. It's leadership, it's people management, it's team building, it's enrollment, it's inspiration, it's creating win-win alignment with people, it's understanding human psychology and human behavior and getting people to do what you want them to do for their reasons. So that everybody feels aligned. Like that's the art of business. And I think that a lot of times people don't want to hear that. They want it. People don't want business to be as much about people as it really is. Because what it does is it forces all your trauma, all your interpersonal relationship defects and deficiencies and imperfections in your communication and even in the way you manage yourself and you conduct yourself and whether or not you're a person that inspires loyalty and enrolls people to a cause and like all this very human, very soft skill kind of stuff comes up to the surface and you realize, man, my struggles in business are really just about my personal struggles. And shit, if I'm going to deal with that stuff, that means I really got to deal with that stuff. Right. And that's a lot messier than just going like, oh, I just need to, you know, get better at running Facebook ads or whatever technical thing people want to point the finger at.
It's not as tactical. It's more so just becoming that leader who can leverage other people.
Look at it this way. Yeah. If you're a good enough leader, you can find the best person in the world at anything you need done and enroll them into doing it for you or doing it with you if you're a good enough leader. And if you're not a good enough leader, usually the best person in the world who has a lot of options, they won't just do it for the money. Wow. And there's no amount you could throw at them to win their interest.
I love that. Is there anything that you've gone through, whether books, trainings, courses, that's helped you level up your leadership to go from 6 to 7 to 8 to 9+ figures?
Yeah, a few thousand hours of therapy and group work and relationship counseling and interpersonal communication coaching and in-depth study of nonviolent communication and Adlerian psychology and rational emotive behavior therapy and dialectical behavior therapy and all types of cognitive behavioral therapy and a little bit of psychedelics. And I mean, dude, once I realized that I could do six figures being a piece of shit human, but that the games I really wanted to play in this world required growth. And I'm being a little bit reductive in saying I was a piece of shit. I think I was a complex person like most of us, but I certainly wasn't there. I mean, John Maxwell, you don't have to read the 21 laws of leadership. You only have to read the first one. It's the law of the lid, John Maxwell. And if your leadership ability is the lid on your potential success. And I had but here's the thing. Business success wasn't a good enough reason to do all that work. Ultimately, the reason I did it is because I was entering my third marriage and this wife came with kids and I was willing to do a lot more painful work on myself to be a good father and a good husband, a good third time husband than I had ever been to be a good business leader. And that's what got me into all that therapy and all that personal work. And if I could fast forward to the moment, the inception moment of Entre Institute, my platform now, it was realizing that all the personal development and therapy and trauma work. And ultimately it became more as much or more about service to others. And I became a facilitator in therapeutic environments, helping other people heal and grow. And that work was actually equipping me with skills that I was taking to my business every day and producing dramatically different results because people were actually enrolled and people were excited and people were committed and people weren't just trading their time for my money. They were actually trying to work with me to build, do something great. Right. And when I realized that connection between personal growth and professional output, that was really the moment in my mind that Entre was born, that I'm going to start an entrepreneurial education platform someday that's really a personal development company.
Love that. That's incredible. You mentioned something as well that I'm curious about. You mentioned you took psychedelics. What kind of psychedelics really helped you in the process, if it helped you at all?
I will say I'm not somebody that's done a ton of that. And I had a guy on my show, on my podcast about a month ago that like literally wrote the book. I think it's called Psychedelics for Everyone as his book. And like we went deep on all that stuff. But for myself, it's really, I've just done a little bit of psilocybin and I will say it's, I don't even really think it's much about psychedelics. Like the point is for me, like we either live a finite life or we live an infinite life. And I'm not here to preach and get theological. I'm just saying like either we make the point of being alive to stay alive or we make the point of being alive something that transcends life itself. And there's really not a lot of middle ground. Like if the point of life is finite and constrained to our time here, then frankly, there's a lot of horrible things that make perfectly good sense. Like why would I not murder someone to take what they have as long as I know I can't get caught and it won't impugn my quality of life if the point is simply to stay alive and play zero sum?
Right.
But if that's not true, then there must be some higher principle. There must be some meta consciousness, we'll call it a God, call it a creative universe or energy, call it source, call it parallel dimensions. I don't care what other people choose to call it. And if we accept that that exists and that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, not the other way around, then damn it, I probably ought to try to spend as much time and energy as possible connecting with that to try to figure out how to make this a little more tolerable, because I think we all know that purely abstractly and superficially, life is like really freaking hard and it's painful. And there's like so much pain built into the human condition, and pain for the sake of what? You know, the Latin word passio means both passion and suffering. It's the root of both words. And to me, that's the existential choice, is like, am I going to transmute this suffering that is part and parcel of simply being a corporeal being that has physiological needs and emotional needs and all the other needs? Am I going to transmute that into something that matters? Or am I just hanging on to stay alive and procreate and spread my DNA? And as soon as you accept the one viewpoint, which to me is the only logical viewpoint, then like, how do you access that? And how do you transcend it? It's like Bob Proctor said, we were not given imaginations because we're meant to like stop dreaming at a certain point.
Mm.
And you know, I don't know if you know that much about evolutionary biology, but like the human organism, the mammal that we are, the Homo sapien, is an incredibly bizarre species. We're basically all born midterm. We're all born prematurely. We're basically all abortions that survived, to put it bluntly and grotesquely. If you look at a human compared to all other mammals, we only spend about a half term in the womb. And then the mother's body ejects us. I mean, if you look at like, if you've ever been on a ranch and you've seen livestock, like a horse or a cow give birth, they born like 5 minutes later, those little babies are walking around. Whereas we got to like roll on our backs for a year and be fed and be completely helpless. Like we're a huge biological liability. I mean, imagine in ancient times having a freaking baby in the wood. It never shuts up. It can't feed itself. It can't even walk. And you're trying not to get eaten by a tiger, right? Why? Why do humans get born prematurely? And the answer is because our heads are so big. Our heads will literally split our mother, our host, in half if they don't push us out after 9 months. And so whatever forces out there that designed this whole thing seemed really intent on us having like bizarrely large craniums such that it puts our mother at mortal risk for daring to even have us. So why does the human brain require the shape of skull that we have? There's two parts of the brain that require our skull to be the shape and size that it is. And it's the part of us that it's the part of the brain that can have a vision with our eyes closed. It's not vision, it's visualization, imagination. And then the other is our language processing that we use to express ideas. So the entire human experiment is this biological hijacking so that a sentient species could be born that has the ability to visualize and communicate ideas. Once I know that, it was pretty hard to accept a life that wasn't basically built around visualizing and communicating ideas, and that anything else is me clearly not being in alignment with the purpose for which all life was designed.
Wow.
And that's why, like, I mean, I'm sorry, but like you take that to its ultimate conclusion, and this is where it becomes hard not to walk around feeling sort of, I don't ever want to say like enlightened, but I just view most, I view many, not most, I view many with great sadness because they've allowed themselves to be convinced that other things matter more and the most important things matter less. And that's why we're not happy. That's why society, that's why the general social survey has us at an all-time low of human happiness in this country.
So you believe that the essentially the reason why humans are alive is to create and express. That's it. And that's kind of what the universe wants from us, is to just create with our imagination and be the expression of whatever the universe is kind of channeling.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a piece, there's a precursor piece missing, which is to input or to intake and operationalize universally grounded values. So it's not like, I mean, you could argue that Adolf Hitler did a masterful job of visualizing, imagining, creating, and expressing ideas.
Right.
But they were built on bad materials. I think there are universally, and this is where, you know, arguments against creation and some sort of source energy and whatnot make no sense to me, because, you know, there has to be a foundation of values that connects us and unites us as humans. Again, it's different from the collective. It's a unity of individuals. It's not a collective. It's not a oneness. It's an infiniteness. And those are very different things. But yeah, I mean, that's what I believe that we're here. You know, the word purpose comes from the French word proposer, which means to propose. It's like that which I propose to the world, that which I stand for in the world. We are meant to stand for values and then find ways to manifest and express them. Again, the word, and this is all like, it's all baked into language. Like, I think ancestrally, like, we knew all this, and in the postmodern world, we've sort of objectified everything into meaninglessness. But I mean, whether you look at the word purpose, that comes from that which I propose, you look at the word profession, the work that I do, that's not what profession means. The word profession historically means that which I profess, my profession of faith, my profession of meaning, my profession of purpose, my profession for my existence. You know, it's more like a testimony is what profession is supposed to mean. It's not just like how I make money. You look at the word fulfillment. People want to be more fulfilled. That's the number one complaint people have. I don't feel fulfilled in my life. The word fulfillment comes from the old English word fulfillon, which means prophecy or destiny. You don't choose how to be fulfilled. It was chosen for you. You have to find it. That's why you're here. Right. Wow. And I think the more you learn about language and history and life itself, the more bizarre our whole world starts to seem. You know, what is the Krishnamurti quote? It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. I don't know, man. At some point, I just kind of stopped caring about fitting in. And that's when life begins.
I love that. Let me ask you this, because you mentioned, you know, as we talked about your story, you kind of grew up in a home where you were blessed. You didn't have to worry about money. You didn't have to worry about all the things, which I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, and all of them have the same story. Came up from nothing, so on and so forth. What made you have that innate desire, I'm assuming, to work really hard when you were starting your businesses? Because for a lot of people, if they have basic needs there, they're not going to work that hard. Especially before all of these things that you figured out around profession and fulfillment and purpose. What made you work hard?
So having grown up around, I'll call it wealthy culture, which is an oversimplified term because there's a lot of variations, but there's some fundamentals around, and again, we like, it's funny because my parents were very successful by most standards, but I was actually like, call it lower middle echelon by the standards of the school that I attended, which was this like elite prep school. And again, the, you know, professional athletes sent their kids to our school and stuff. And my parents were like working to make the tuition, and other people, it was like a rounding error in their daily interest or whatever. What I'll say is that culture, and this was when I was a kid. So this is a 30 or 40 year dated statement. I'm 44 now, but it's very much about fitting in. Like there are expectations. I mean, we even had this thing that we went to when we were in middle school that was almost like, it was almost like priming. It was like learning your manners and learning how to do these certain stupid dance steps that you're expected to know when you go to like debutante balls and all this stupid society bullshit that ironically I ended up playing piano for later and just rolling my eyes the whole time. Cause it was like, hey, you guys have made your whole world about acquiescing to this construct that you never got a say in. Nobody asked you if this was the society you wanted to belong to, but you just do it because your parents did it. And they tell you how much worse it is before when they grew up and they didn't have money. And this is the price you pay to have money, is now you got to fit into this scene. And so the question that you're really asking is, why didn't Jeff want to play? Why wasn't I on that program? And the answer is because I grew up getting my ass bullied so bad. I grew up with a genetic condition. I was a kind of a weird looking kid. I'm still not, you know, nobody's asked me to grace any magazine covers, but it was worse when I was a kid. I had this kind of, people would ask me if I was retarded or, you know, if I rode the short bus to school, and I got bullied brutally. I had like a pronounced unibrow that didn't do me any favors as a kid. And I just got bullied so bad that I, at an early age, and this is where a lot of the therapy was necessary, I developed a little bit of a misanthropy. I was like, why the hell would I ever want to conform to a society that's populated with these assholes?
Mm.
And so you ask why I worked so hard, because I always had to, because the hardest work in this world is being different. And so I think I just accepted that like there is no mainstream path for me, but being on the alternative path, the road less traveled, is a hell of a lot of work, and I just need to resign myself to that for life. And it's funny because now I've come to, again, that transmutation of suffering into passion, the Passio concept. I've allowed that now to define my life in a way that I'm very excited about on a daily basis. Like I love working really hard. Because, you know, it's man's search for meaning. Man's search for meaning is the greatest adventure we'll ever undertake. And by the way, the word entrepreneur, literally translated from the French, means adventurer, one who undertakes an adventure. And so to me, it's not even about starting businesses. It's about living my life. The number one regret of the dying. There was this data published by a doctor that works with in hospice work, a, you know, end of life care doctor. I'm forgetting the word for whatever reason, but he said, I ask every one of my patients, you know, what they've learned and what their regrets are, and the number one regret of the dying is that I lived a life that someone else planned out for me instead of figuring out what my life was supposed to look like.
Mm.
But I think the reason a lot of people take that path is because it's less work to let other people design your life for you,
right?
But I embrace the hard work, and that's the starting point for figuring out who you're supposed to be.
I love that. What were some books on your journey that made a world of a difference, whether it was personal development or business?
People of the Lie by Scott Peck. It's an attempt to understand human evil from like a medical pathology perspective rather than like a moral judgment perspective. And it helped me really, probably as much as any book I've ever read, understand the subtle depravity of human nature and the things to really be on guard for in myself. Because by the time you come face to face with your own, I'll use the term evil in a pathological descriptive sense, not in a moral sense. You're doing damage control at that point. And so to really understand how the human psyche goes off the rails was really valuable for me, because I think when you, the road, call it the road more traveled, right? Like the socially accepted mainstream path through the system with the student loans and the promotions and the career achievements and the titles and the social esteem and the retirement, you know, package at the end of the rainbow. And like that whole path, fundamentally, it's a lure because it's actually very unnatural. If you look at human development, it's a very unnatural path to say, like, I'm just going to do what other people tell me I should my whole life. But yet in America and in the westernized world, that's what most people end up doing. And that's why we have that number one regret. But if you really look at why that is, it's because there's a sense of safety in relying on the collective to do a lot of your thinking for you. Because when you have to think about everything your damn self, like it's exhausting. Right. It could just be a lot easier to just abdicate most of life's big decisions, right? Otherwise, I got to weigh so much and I got to constantly learn how to manage the anxiety of wondering if I made the right choice because it was my choice. It wasn't sanctioned for me by other people that it was easy for me to say, well, I trust them, so I'll trust what they tell me I'm supposed to do. Like a self-determined life is a lot of freaking work. And, you know, I guess books. So yeah, I mean, books. I mentioned Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged. I mentioned a lot of existential fiction, Dostoevsky. But I mean, as far as like more accessible stuff, I mean, a lot of the classic personal development stuff, Think and Grow Rich, Awaken the Giant Within by Tony Robbins, The Richest Man in Babylon, The Greatest Salesman on Earth, The Magic of, gosh, Wallace Tuttle?
Thinking Big?
There's The Magic of Thinking Big. And then there's, I don't know, dude, I over the years, I've basically read anything, the entire personal development section of the bookstore, I basically have read. But I actually find other stuff to be more stimulating and interesting, because I kind of feel like with personal development, once you get it, you get it.
Right.
And it's really a lifestyle more than like an epiphany. Like it's like, I'm going to take on the difficulty of self-determination. And but I mean, like for me, it was more nuanced stuff. I would say like Eric Berne's work on transactional analysis and understanding human interaction, that was incredibly powerful for me, even directly applied to sales, but also more broadly than that. Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. I've done a lot of study of the Austrian School of Economics, guys like Karl Menger and Ludwig von Mises, but Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, I think, is a really good starting point there to sort of develop a lot of my pro-entrepreneurship, kind of libertarian economic ideals. I mean, at the end of the day, what I would say to most people is I don't even care what you read, but A, read more, and B, try to read something that's not fiction.
Mm.
Ayn Rand, maybe, and works like that, or Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment. I mean, there's historical, or not historical fiction, but fiction from historical times, from the past, tended to have a lot more like philosophical and thematic grounding. But I mean, if you're reading the entire oeuvre of Dean Koontz or James Patterson, I probably question how good the reading really is for you, although entertainment is good too. But like, just freaking read, man. Less social media, less television, more reading. Let's start there.
I agree. I'm not a huge fan of fiction books because I feel like my brain just doesn't work that way. I like to watch a movie instead. But yeah, I agree. More nonfiction. What I like to do at the end of these is just toss a bunch of rapid fire questions and just to see how people think. So first thing that comes to your mind, kind of blurt out, and then we can go through every question one at a time.
Okay. Love it.
Three traits or words that your friends would use to describe you.
Obsessed, loving, difficult to get close to.
Interesting. What are your three positive traits that you feel like you need to work on? Three positive traits that you feel like you maybe are missing.
I'd like to be easier to get close to. I think because I'm so intense sometimes, warmth, the word warmth comes to mind. Like my wife is super warm, so I get a lot of warmth by proxy and positive association. But like, I would like to be a person that feels more like a being wrapped in a loving blanket to be close to. And then I think I'm reaching the point in my life where I'd like to be a little less dissatisfied all the time. Hmm. I mean, dissatisfaction is really healthy in a lot of ways. Like I said, it's not a measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society, but it'd be nice to be a little more chill.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. I was talking to someone today and they said, you know, most entrepreneurs, they just need to accept the fact that they're going to be hungry all the time. Yeah. And I find that to be a common cause. What would you say is your...
Yeah, let me say, especially when you understand that the concept of entrepreneurship is about adventure. It's not about greed.
I like the fact that you also know every word, the history of every word. I need to start to think of these things because I feel like it's been botched over time.
Yeah. And I think that language has its own epigenetics where like we say a word now today based on what we think it means in popular parlance, but there's a lineage, there's an ancestry to the word that's present when we in the energy around the word when we speak it, whether we know it or not. Mm. And so for me, it's really important to just know what I'm saying when I speak. And if you don't know the history of words, you don't really know the meaning of words.
I love that. What would you say is your greatest fear?
Dying with regrets.
Any specific regret or just dying with regret?
I mean, I think I would only ever have one type of regret, which would be a failure to give all I had in pursuit of whatever my purpose was for being here.
I love that. What would you say is the best quote or quote that you live by and you regularly think about?
I have this tattooed on my arm, which I'll turn the mic so I can say it. It says, "Don't wish it was easier, wish you were better."
I love that.
And that's a Jim Rohn quote. I'm also going to quote George Bernard Shaw and say, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man."
I love that. Does religion at all play a factor into your life? And if so, why? If not, why not?
So the Latin root of the word religion is religare, which means to bind or tie up. I've never been a big fan of being bound and tied up. So I have eschewed most formal man-made religious constructs. I have a deep, deep relationship with God. I have a deep grounding in my accepted truth of Jesus Christ as God embodied and sent here for a very specific teleological and eschatological purpose that is, for me, life doesn't make a lot of sense without. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not here to convert anyone else except through, you know, dialectical like rhetoric. I mean, if people want to know how I think, I'll share. So spirituality is as much a part of my life as religion is not.
I love that. What animal would you pick as your spirit animal or animal to be reincarnated to?
Those might be two different answers. Spirit animal is definitely a wolf. I've always loved wolves. That sort of like they're pack animals, but frankly, they do their best work alone. Yeah, as far as gosh, coming back to life, I don't know. I don't know about that one. I mean, my mom was involved in Yellowstone Park for a long time in her retirement. And I know, unfortunately, a lot about how wolves get treated in nature. So I'm not sure I'd want to come back as well.
If you could pick one superpower, what would that be?
I'd want to be able to visit the realm on the other side of whatever this is. And like, experience that wisdom and that clarity and bring it back here in a more methodical, like deliberate way. I mean, there's ways to access consciousness now or, you know, super consciousness, I should say, but I'd like to have a little more command of that faculty.
That's awesome. Dude, Jeff, thank you so much for hopping on this podcast. For anybody who wants to know more about what you do, find out about your work, where can they find you?
Probably my YouTube channel is like the easiest place to start. I don't post as much there anymore because I'm so freaking busy running this company. You know, careful what you wish for, right? But yeah, if you go to Jeff, just look up Jeff Lerner on YouTube. I have, especially if you go back to a lot of my older trainings, you can, like, I just think that the great fallacy in this world is that strategic problems need tactical solutions. Most of the life's challenges are not created by what we're doing. They're created by how we're thinking.
Mm.
And so a lot of my earlier work was really trying to work out how to think about life more than necessarily what to do about it. And that's frankly why I think I've been as successful as I have in the last 5 years, is because I started the journey with the right questions. And if somebody wants to trace that journey, it's all on my YouTube channel.
I love that. I'll leave all your links, including social media as well, if anybody wants to find you on there. But YouTube is the main place. And dude, thank you so much for hopping on. For everybody who was listening, I would suggest, there was so much here, especially with quotes, recommendations, diving deep into a lot of the spiritual aspects of things. I would recommend to go back and watch this a second or even third time. Any last comments or anything you want to share to the world before we hop off?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very blessed in my work at Entre. I get to be very involved in our personal development, our live personal development events. And I get to, I mean, I just this weekend, I was in a room with 100 people that are working on breaking through and creating this different kind of life. And it, you know, it's a cliche to say what we have to fear is fear itself, but like, that's what I would say to people is like, usually when we're afraid of things, when our fear is not serving us, it's because there are still unanswered or unasked questions. Mm-hmm. Why am I afraid of this? What do I need? What is it that I currently believe to be true that is threatened by whatever this thing is that I'm afraid of, right? And I think if we ask deep enough questions, we'll get to a place. I mean, this has been my journey where most of the things that society tells us to be afraid of are actually the solutions. And many of the things that society tells us to embrace are actually the poisons, depending on how we contextualize our life. And that, like, fear is a signal to go in a direction. And the direction is toward the fear, not away from it. That's what I would say to people. And this shows up practically for me, of like people wanting to start a business. And they're like, well, I want to become an entrepreneur. I want to live this adventure life, but I'm scared. And I'm like, well, what are you scared of? I'm scared of my friends judging me. I'm scared of my spouse not supporting me. I'm scared of taking a financial risk. I'm scared of wasting my college degree. I'm scared, like all these things that they're scared of. The best life they could possibly live is on the other side of resolving those fears, not avoiding them. Why? You're scared your wife isn't going to support you? Well, what is that the tip? What iceberg is that the tip of in your relationship, right? That your wife isn't going to support, that you don't want to die with regret because you traded all the best years of your life just to hang on and not disappoint. And that's not a conversation you're equipped to have with them. Because you haven't been clear from the beginning of what your expectations of each other truly were in a marriage and what your needs are. And you don't actually know how to convey your needs in a way that enrolls them to support you. And so, like, let's get to that, because not only would that mean that you could pursue your business that you're thinking about, that would mean that every aspect of your life would be enriched because you'd up-level your communication and your ability to connect with relationships of all types. And so, like, again, it's just going to the deeper questions on the other side of the fear is where all the gold is. And that's where it's like sad, because I feel like, I don't know, people, they don't want to do that much work. A lot of times
they have to open up the door to all of the tip of the icebergs that are there that they're just kind of ignoring.
Yeah. Yeah. So go towards the fear. That's what I'm trying to say.
I love that. Dude, thank you so much, Jeff. And we'll stay on for a little bit here, but for everybody, hope you had an incredible time. Again, watch this back, and I'm going to leave all the links for Jeff down below.